The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome again, everybody. Nice to see you here tonight. It's nice to see you all here again. It's been a while since you've spoken or program here at the center. And some of you know Nya O or Marilyn Habermas here. Some of you probably haven't met her before, but she's a long-time member of the Vipassana community in town, but an even longer-term member of the Zen community in town. It's a Zen priest, and currently practices often down at Hokkyoji, the monastery that Katagiri Roshi founded back, when did they buy the land?
My gosh. In the olden days,
1970s. So she practices down there with that teacher named Jyotai, and does a lot of her own solo practice down there when she has an opportunity. Marilyn, it's southeastern Minnesota, right in the corner. And Marilyn has, also has a long time arts background in dance, voice, has taught voice for a long time, kind of a combination of awareness, voice, and healing. It's a point where those three things meet, and teaches in town and around town Zen or mindfulness practice. So, thanks so much for coming, Yoko.
Thank you.
Journey, Steve.
Thank you. Hi. Can you hear me in the back? So if you get so you can't hear me, will you like go like this or something? Okay, thank you. So good evening, everybody. Well, I want to start with part of a poem by Mary Oliver, and the name of the poem is Work. I heard her. I bet some of you were there too. I heard her read this poem. This last May when she was in town, and it really kind of stopped my mind. But I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's kind of long, but I'll just read bits. Work by Mary Oliver. I am a woman 60 years old and of no special courage. Every day, a little conversation with God or his envoy, the tall pine, or the grass-swimming cricket. Every day, I study the difference between water and stone. Every day, I stare at the world. I push the grass aside and stare at the world. The spring pickerel in the burn and the shine of the tight-packed water. The sweetness of the child on the shore. Also its radiant temper. The snail climbing the morning glories, carrying his heavy wheel. The green throats of the lilies turning from the wind. This is the world. And then the next piece. Would it be better to sit in silence, to think everything, to feel everything, to say nothing? This is the way of the orange gourd. This is the habit of the rock in the river, over which the water pours all night and all day. But the nature of man is not the nature of silence. Words are the thunders of the mind. Words are the refinement of the flesh. Words are the responses to the thousand curvaceous moments. We just manage it, sweet and electric. Words flow from the brain and out the gate of the mouth. We make books of them out of hesitations and grammar. We are slow and choosy. This is the world. I'll come back to Mary Oliver a little bit later. So that might seem like a funny poem to read in a place where we practice silence, but I don't think so. I am just coming home in a way. I got sent away to study in a faraway monastery called the Inside Out Upside Down Monastery last year. And in this monastery, I had to use words and words and words. I had to write papers, reflection papers, and I had to talk with people all day long. Every day for a year. It was shocking. So now I'm home, so to say. And that's kind of shocking. So I have reverse culture shock. So where was I? Where was this Inside Out Upside Down Monastery? It was about 10 blocks that way at University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview, where I was studying and practicing clinical pastoral education and learning how to be a chaplain. So it was really a gift to do that work. It was deep, shallow, challenging, opening, and demanding. I felt called to see where the rubber hit the road in terms of the practice in the world. In the world, Mary Oliver's world. And also, I wanted to be with everybody. So when I practice Zen and Vipassana, I'm with a kind of narrow ribbon of the whole community that we live in. And I wanted to be with everyone, which of course we're with everyone. But I wanted to be with everyone in my role as a priest. I just wanted to see what I needed to find out about that. And I found out. I wanted to kind of test. I had this idea that at bottom, we can meet each other where it matters, no matter what our religious, cultural, class, educational story might be. And I wanted to see if that was true or not, at least for me. So I guess my conclusion was that, yeah, we can, mostly. And when I couldn't, I think it's because I missed something. I missed a cue. One time I was working in the, palliative care area, and I had a patient who was dying, but he didn't kind of get that he was, and his wife knew he was, and I was having this very great conversation with his wife, and something in the way I spoke or something, it dawned on her that I probably wasn't a Christian, and she completely closed the gate. That was over. Hi, Jerry. And that was a moment where I couldn't get back on track. We had this heart-opening conversation, and suddenly the door shut. And what I learned from that was that's what happened. The door shut, to just accept that. But I kept thinking, there's something I should do instead of just respecting that and offering to get her a Christian, which I'm not. So at the end of my year-long residency, a very strong metaphor rose for me. It was about a bridge. Of course, the bridge, you know, became a metaphor for all of us, I think. So this was about being a bridge for me. I am a crossover person. I'm an artist, so I'm always looking at what connected to what that most people aren't thinking about, maybe. And I do Zen, I do Vipassana, I make no apologies for both. I'm always looking for what's at the bottom. So throughout the 16 months of my clinical pastoral education training, I struggle to reconcile several aspects of difference So this was a great big koan. Do you know koan from Zen practice? For me. So a koan is a teaching story that seems impossible to solve. You know, we like have them every day in our lives. So here's some pieces of my koan. I grew up in a Jewish family, so I was never in the mainstream to begin with. So in clinical pastoral education in the hospital, I was right in the middle of the mainstream. That meant Christian culture, basically. I said that I spent years of my life as an artist, so I was always commenting on the culture and trying to call it to something deeper and more beautiful. But now I was right in the middle. I wasn't on the edge going, I was right in the middle. I also don't practice Western medicine, really. And now I was in the biggest research hospital in the state. That was really challenging. In fact, one day my ear was hurting. And I was going, ow, ow, in the nursing station. I was taking notes and kind of like, ow, ow. And one of the nurse practitioner doctors said, she's not a doctor, but kind of like a doctor, she said, what's wrong? I said, oh, my ear really hurts. She said, oh, you should take Sudafed. And I just went blank. I was like, what? You know, like, I didn't know what she was talking about. I thought, I'm not going to take Sudafed. I'm going to go home and put mullein and garlic in my ear. Why would I take Sudafed? I had the presence of mind to go, oh, thank you. But that's what's going on in my head. So then I realized, whoa, right. I'm somewhere else. I often see possibility before there's a structure to support it, and this has gotten me in trouble in my life. So it was really a struggle to live with that kind of sight in the middle of the behemoth of a corporate academic world. And I've already said about talking. So Zen, according to the founder of Zen, Bodhidharma, teaches no dependence on words and letters. It's a tradition outside words and letters, supposedly, even though there's like 1,400 koans and zillions of books of commentary, supposedly, it's outside words and letters. But anyway, the practice of Zen and Vipassana is the dismantling of concepts. So I was in a culture of clinical pastoral education where all I did was write papers and have to talk about what I was thinking about. It was shocking. Especially at first. I was just like, I think the first week we had to tell our story. Now, I just turned 57, and the people I was training with were 26. and we were supposed to tell our story. Like, you know, where you came, blah, blah, blah. And I had just come from a month in the monastery. My head was shaved. Training group, and I was like, tell the story about who? I mean, I didn't even know how to talk. So that's very interesting. So the language of intimacy is used throughout the commentary on the literature of my tradition in Zen. And the basis of insight and compassion stems from intimacy with every nuance of creation. I'm not saying that's different than Vipassana or anything. I think that's love. So the insights that come from this practice are about direct experience of reality. And they seem to mirror pretty much exactly the insights of all mystics and all traditions that I've come across, even though they came to those insights through a different way. Because I perceive this to be so, it reinforced my trust of this practice, and it allowed me to be over there in that upside-down monastery offering spiritual care. Do you kind of see that? That was a way I could figure out how I could be there with everyone who was coming from a world I didn't know very well. So my way of being a bridge is being a bridge between inner and outer to find and manifest new pathways. One of the doctors over there, who's kind of a mystic, talked to me about the bridge falling down. She thought that it was a message that said we need to find new pathways. She thinks that medicine is bound by a very narrow view of outcomes and presumes it has the right to name and value those outcomes. So that was one person I found I could talk to there. So to move between boundaries, to point to what's possible, where the transformation is truly possible, proved to be within my own heart. In the shredding of my own conditioned habits of mind. So that was hard. But I'm grateful. But it's not easy. The first time I was on call means you go home and you take the beeper and you could get called all night because somebody died or someone wants to talk to someone. So I'd never done that before. I was already nervous. It was winter. And I remember I was just lying on my living room floor getting ready to stretch after a whole week because it was Friday. Me! Bye, honey. Gotta go. And it was someone died. And I was scared. I was like, oh my God. What do I do? I called my friend who's an Episcopal minister and I said, what do I do? So I got there and I got in the elevator and I was going in and there was a nursing assistant or something in the elevator and she said, how are you? And I said, I'm totally freaked out. I said, I'm a chaplain intern and I just got called to a death. And she said, breathe. When I got up there, I found that somehow mindfulness took over. And there's always someone in the family who is the sort of spokesperson, that just you have to just pay attention until you find that person and takes over and sort of decides what the group is going to do. So this man said, well, now, are you a Baptist minister? And I was like, oh, oh my God, if he only knew, he just, oh. I said, well, we're here to take care of everyone. So we're not from any particular church. This last year of journeying set me to move between my own boundaries and set me to manifest new pathways in my own heart and to point myself to what's possible when the old narrow bridge falls into the river. So in honor of the interfaith nature of my journey, I offer this nigun from the Hasidic Jewish tradition, created by Reb Nachman of Bratslav, who was a famous mystic, who I like a lot. It means in English, the whole world is a very narrow bridge, and the main thing is not to fear at all. So I'll just sing a little bit, and you can just enjoy. Kol halom kulo geshet zar me'od, geshet zar me'od, geshet zar me'od. Ve'haika, ve'haika, lo lifachet, lo lifachet klar, ve'haika, Gesher zar meot, gesher Geshe-tsame, O Geshe-tsame. So the first part of my talk is called Reconciliation. There was an ongoing struggle for me with translation. Translation, actually we're always translating, right? So it's not special, but it was just more apparent. Embedded in the language of clinical pastoral education, it's coming from a Protestant world, that's where it came from. They discovered that it was important to read the human document, which is, duh. I mean, great, right? And I endorsed that. But there were assumptions of how one's spiritual life unfolded, embedded in the language. And it was very hard. You know, when you're in the majority, you don't have to know that there's assumptions embedded in our language. And a lot of us are in the majority, and there's a lot of things we don't have to know. But when you're in the minority, you bump into them. And I was in the minority. So my teachers were unaware of these assumptions. So I felt lonely and sometimes struck dumb, like I didn't even know what to say. And sometimes I felt angry because I felt often I had to do all the translation, and it was tiring and lonesome, and I was homesick, and I was tired of explaining. So just imagine how the Buddha felt when he returned to Deer Park to his five friends who thought that he was screwed up, and they thought he was nuts at first. You know, eventually they woke up. So he felt those same things. And I wished I'd had the courage of Bodhidharma, who went to China from India and looked the Chinese emperor in the eyes, which, you know, you could get your head cut off for doing that, and told him that all his accomplishments had no merit. But I wasn't Bodhidharma. So I had to just scrabble along as I could. Sometimes I would just hit a wall and just feel despairing. It was just like working with a koan or a creative project. You know, I would hit the wall and then there would be a softening and a shift. It was like stuck, then falling apart, then shift, then insight. Towards the end of the year, I found myself able to carry wood in one direction and water in the other. And what I mean by that is I saw the gift that the training that we do is, and I was able to bring it to the clinical pastoral education without sort of a defendedness or tension. And I also longed to bring the clarity that I learned about naming dynamics and speaking to them directly that my training at the hospital offered to me. And I wanted to bring these back to my Zen communities who have struggled with silence and right speech. Yeah? So you know about that? What's right? How do we speak? What's happening? We should be quiet. That's the shadow side. So then we don't say it. And then it festers. Yeah? So I felt grateful that now I had a little more movement inside me, that I could go to deep silence and I could start to name things. That's mindfulness, right? So now I want to talk about Job and Joshu. So have you heard of Job? Yeah, okay. Have you heard of Joshu? No. Joshu is this like super duper famous Chinese Zen master who studied till, and then he traveled all around, and when he was 80 years old he started to teach. And he lived in a little shack, and he had this famous little bridge near his shack. So I'll talk about that. You see the bridge, that's the connection there. Okay. So One thing I really enjoyed is that the Dharma is everywhere, including in Christianity and in the Gospel and in the Old Testament Psalms. So it was joyful for me to see the wisdom there. And then here's Job. That's us. We're suffering. Isn't that why we practice? Because we noticed we were suffering. So, here's a quote from Job. For 7 days and seven nights, Job's friends sat beside him on the ground, and none of them spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. That's what we do as spiritual care people. So, chaplains, but I'm speaking us. We listen to stories and stories and stories. We not only listened, but we interacted with the stories. Not only that, but we had to tell stories to our teachers and colleagues. At first, this was very confusing to me. How could I help people by doing this? This was not exactly what I was trying to do as a Zen teacher. Right? Which is to take my sword out and cut through the stories. We were being trained in deep listening. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about deep listening from a different angle. So this great guy named Arthur Franck, he wrote an article and he said, the story, to be worth that name, is the ground on which subjectivities meet in mutual knowing. This fundamental need is to know and to be known. So meeting, subjectivities meeting in mutual knowing, doesn't that sound familiar? It sounds like Dharma to me. And to know and be known. That sounds like practice to me. How is this knowing happening? Is what we would ask. That's maybe the only little bit and big bit of difference. So to be known intimately in its moment to moment arising and dissipating, and to listen without an agenda as Job's good friends did. This is Don't Know Mind. Do you know Don't Know Mind? That's a Zen thing. So the subject-object paradigm, which spiritual practice sees through, and which modern medicine doesn't see through, breaks here. And this leads to healing, because there's only subject. Right? There's only subject. Inside and outside are fundamentally not separate, and when we feel that, we completely relax. So that's healing. That's no suffering. So when I can listen like Job's friends, and we join the teller of the story beyond just being with, you know, being with, that's good, but when we completely go on their side, completely, then this is healing and compassion. Compassion is suffering with, right? So, back to the bridge. Fukushima Roshi says that bridge means great compassion. So this is the bridge. This is the Zen bridge. Okay. So, this is how, have you ever heard Zen stories? I'm excited to share this with you. Because this is a monk said, like that goes. A monk, that's us, came to Joshu and said, Joshu's stone bridge is very famous and I came to see it. I thought it would be big, but it's very tiny. Then the monk made a joke and said, Joshu is very famous, but he's very small and very old. That's pretty rude. And Josha replied, you are just looking at a small bridge, but you are not seeing the real bridge. And you look at an old priest, but you do not see the master. He deserved that one, though. So then he said, this bridge lets donkeys pass and horses pass. So the poem goes, donkeys cross over, horses cross over, cross over, cross over. That's the bridge. Do you get it? Donkeys, everyone. This bridge is for everyone. Donkeys, slow, stupid, stubborn. I can totally relate to that. Horses, competent, wonderful, brilliant, gorgeous, fast. Doesn't matter. In Zen, it means that Joshu becomes the bridge. That's how we cross over the bridge. I'm telling you a big secret. I'm saving you from the stick in the future. When you see a bridge, become a bridge. So when you see the suffering, become the suffering. As a companion. That's what we did. However, in another story with Joshu, a monk asks, when all the myriad things come all at once, what should we do? That sounds like everyday life, doesn't it? Which thing should I, where's my date book? What should I do? Okay. Then Joshu says, don't call out their names. What? What does that mean? So at first, when I hear that, I think, well, wait a second now. This guy who's teaching me clinical pastoral education, Arthur Frank, this fabulous article, he's saying, look at the story. What kind of story is it? All this stuff about the story. But in our practice, we say, that's just a story. Drop the storyline. And so that can be good because it just cuts through our mind habits sometimes. Yeah, and so we get some relief. On the other hand, it can lead to spiritual bypassing. And we can skip over the complex texture of the story because it's not spiritually PC. Well, it's just my story. It's just my story. So very odd for me, after 30 years of learning how to dismantle the story and the self that holds the story, to be spending hour after hour after hour listening to stories that convene a history, a past, a present, a future, and a self, and hope. There was a lot of talk about hope, which I didn't even know what to do with. What is that? And not only that, we studied stories, like there's restitution stories, chaos stories, quest stories. We studied the laments and the psalms. So what is this? One side says, name. That sounds like mindfulness. And Joshu says, don't call out their name. I'll come back to Joshu. So I want to go over back to the side of Job and the laments. Because what I discovered, and I was taught, and then I saw it happen, is that the structure of the laments and the psalms are exactly the structure of healing that we do. So if it's known that that's what's happening, we can support each other. So in the psalms, in the laments, we address our complaint to a friend or God. We complain. We petition. We remind, if we're Christian, God of his promise to help and how powerful he claims to be. We confess our trust in his promise, and then we praise and express gratitude. So the process of it This actually happened over and over. We are clear and honest about what we're expressing. That's like the 12-step program. Right? That's mindfulness. In the expressing and being witnessed, we actually get to experience the paradox of our situation. We're sharing our lament with someone empowered to hear. So that empowered to hear brings some kind of magic to the situation. So that could be a friend, a therapist, a priest, a teacher. And then what happens? Our consciousness shifts the relationship with our experience into a new place, a place in which there's more insight and we suffer less. I, honest to God, I saw this almost daily. One time I was working with a patient who used to be a nurse and she didn't want to complain. And she said, oh, you know, I don't want to complain. And I just heard these words come out of my mouth. She was a Christian. If you don't tell God where you're at, how can he find you and help you? And it just kind of came out and I was like, wow, that's pretty good. Who said that? But it's a way of being mindful. So when we're practicing meditation, if we don't let ourselves know, if it's not known what's happening, how can help arise? Right? So it's not really different. This is part of my reconciliation practice. So in Judeo-Christian practice, it's addressed to, well, I don't know actually, but it seems like it's addressed to an external, a powerful external force. And in Zen Buddhist practice, the cry is known directly in the experience of the practitioner, which is Buddha Dharma Sangha operating in the great function. Fukushima Roshi says, Zen amplifies experience. So does lament amplify experience. So in terms of helping beings, which is what I vowed to do, I hope I can use whatever is skillful in the moment. So in over there at the hospital, it meant I would use whatever language spoke to my patient. So I prayed to God or Jesus or Mary or whatever had power for my patient. And it was a process of gathering their pain and their hope and their aspiration and their spiritual container and the aspiration that they hadn't voiced yet but I could feel, and giving it back to them in the container of a prayer. And when I did this, the energy shifted. It was palpable. I was shocked because I had never done that before in my life, that kind of prayer. I told my sister the other night, if I called Jesus, he came. If I called Mary, she came. And if I called God, well, there's no coming and going. So everything was there then. One time I was on call on a Saturday and I went to the room of a Native American teenager who was quite ill. Her grandmother was there and her room, luckily, was right on the river. And it was October, so it was gorgeous. And she said, are you a Christian? And I was like, oh no, here we go. No. I said, no, I'm not. She said, what are you? I said, I'm a Zen Buddhist priest. She said, good, then I want you to do the prayer. I was like, okay. Okay. All right. So I said, well, who would you like me to pray to? She just looked at me and she went, the Creator, of course. It's like, right. Okay. So just using the resources I had, I just sat with her. I felt intimidated. Her grandmother really had a presence. I felt like, well, I'm an idiot. You know, what can I do? But and in spite of being an idiot. So I sat there and I looked at the river and I breathed and I felt my heart just crack. This is a young person, very ill. And I yelled loud. I mean, I talked kind of loud. And I said the one thing I know how to say in Ojibwe. ho, mitakayase, all my relatives. And then I talked to the river, and I called on the river to come and heal her. I mean, it was like channeling or something. And then when we got done, we were quiet, and then I left, and the grandmother was really happy. And I was really happy. What, how fabulous to just drop my idea of being an idiot, of being a Buddhist, of not being a Native American, of being anything, and just open to the moment. So Joshu's answer, don't call out their names, I think means profound intimacy with the flashing moments we call our story. So that's what we know from practice. It's a flash, flashing moment. On the other side of the world, they call it a story. Don't call out their names. It means just total intimacy, beyond words and letters. So sometimes that happens, like the holy. Now I use the word holy, and then I started to say, oh, that was the Holy Spirit. I started to cross over into this other world. One time I was working with a man who was very, very ill, very ill. He'd been in this unit for a long time, and I'd gone to talk to him, and he wasn't a person who talked very much, so there were a lot of silences. And his wife was there, and he was going to go home from the unit. He was going to go to his house. And I said, I didn't know what to say because I knew he was so sick. So I said, well, are you ready to go home now? And suddenly, you know what I said? I just meant it in the most ordinary way, but suddenly it turned. Something turned. And suddenly, that's not the question that I was asking. I was asking a different level of question. I didn't even mean to be. And I just felt that, and I was told myself to shut up and not say anything. And the wife started to cry, and everything fell apart. There was no coming and no going. It was truly a moment of the non-dual just making itself known to me. It was holy. That's what my Christian friends would say. That was holy. It was okay. Everything was okay. There was no suffering. So I feel grateful to have experienced that. There was no calling the name then. Yeah? You know what I'm saying? So I would say that lament is simply not cutting off what is happening. That's what we do when we sit. We don't cut it off. And then the chaplain or you as a friend are the embodied equanimity and mindfulness. So when we put those together, I guess we get this. When we put those together, that might be relief. Sometimes it's words and sometimes it's not words. So the last thing I want to talk about is salvation. I didn't really get it. I didn't know what it meant. I really tried to understand how salvation, which I kind of knew as complete acceptance and insight to the way things is. Suzuki Roshi used to say, the way things is. What is that from a Christian understanding? Like even intellectually, let alone in my heart? When I would read the Gospels, I'd get high. I thought, wow, Jesus is awesome. He's totally enlightened. But the interpretation of Jesus' teaching that my patients often held, I found confusing, honestly, for me. I'm not criticizing, I just was confusing. So I understand the way things is to be God or emptiness. So kind of saying that myriad causes and conditions known as they is, that is empty of self nature, are just clear, discrete, and fully free moments happening at a speed that's beyond human consciousness. In this is kind of relief and repose and rest and compassion that arises naturally. Having the experience of this, our faith in the way things is strengthened for me. And it's very direct. There's no mediating story. And I think that's what tripped me up. But there's a zillion mediating stories. So probably if I had a deep relationship with those mediating stories, it would have been less confusing for me. So what we practice here in Buddhist meditation is actually very rare and subtle. I'm not saying it's special, this is just a fact. It's unusual to do this kind of work. Very few people on the planet actually engage their investigation in this way, Buddhist or not. So I have a list of inspiring people. St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Reb Nachman, Rabbi Hillel, Rumi, Hafiz, Hildegard of Bingen, Julian of Norwich, Ehe Dogen, Hui Neng, Iron Grinder Liu, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, and everyone in this room. So most people that I talked to, what they hoped for from me was consolation and comfort. Sometimes as a Zen teacher, that's what I offer, and I'm pretty gentle, but more often than not in that role, I'm taking the rug and going like that. So that was kind of confusing to me. Stephen Batchelor says that Christianity is about existential consolation and that Buddhism is about existential confrontation. So it's a little different approach. It's just a different approach. In preparation for this, I called a pastor, a minister, and I said, I know this is kind of ridiculous, and I don't want to take too much of your time, but could you say something about Christian salvation really fast? I'm giving a talk tonight. I said, I'm sorry to ask you, well, you know, just whatever you would say. And this is so great. So with no prompting from me, right, he said, it's an experience of oneness with all of life, and not just personally, but with all of life. It's meant to be shared. It's living in reconnection in the midst of brokenness. Samsara nirvana, samsara nirvana, samsara nirvana. Sometimes it's more internal. He didn't say samsara nirvana. I'm saying that. Sometimes it's more internal and sometimes it's more external, he said. And then I said, wow, that sounds like Zen. I said, well, what does Jesus have to do with all that? And he said, well, Jesus is like a unique example of this. And then he said, well, maybe it's not so unique. He said his death on the cross is for him the affirmation of God joining with him in the broken places, in the suffering, that it's all holy and it can all be made holy. Wow. I'm not confused at all. I understand this. Sounds like Dharma to me. Does it sound like Dharma to you at all? In Zen, we say samsara and nirvana, nirvana and samsara, not separate. Living fully in impermanence, the way things is. So the Buddha, according to historical text, abjured us famously with his final words. This I tell you, decay is inherent in all conditioned things. Work out your own salvation with diligence. We've all heard that before a few times. Yeah. And also, these are both from the Digha Nikaya. And whosoever shall be an island unto themselves and a refuge unto themselves shall take to themselves no other refuge, but seeing truth as an island, seeing as a refuge truth, shall not seek refuge in anyone but themselves. It is they who shall reach the further shore, but they must make the effort themselves. So that's what I've been trained in. And this is very different than what I heard from my patients, was that Jesus' death and sacrifice guaranteed their salvation. Now, I don't actually get that feeling from St. John of the Cross, but just general Christianity at the hospital, that's what people said a lot, and they really believed it, and it was really consoling for them. But the talk about these are ideas. And my experience is that those who take on this work do actually make a huge effort, whatever their faith background is. And this is Zen. What is the direct experience of salvation? What's your direct experience of salvation? All of the enlightening beings who have inspired and energized my efforts, who continue to do so, come from myriad traditions. I think that's why I like doing interfaith chaplaincy so much. Their words and methods differ, but they all report the same view from the top of the mount. Here's a poem by E.Q. Zen master, wild and crazy Zen master from Japan. Many paths lead from the foot of the mountain, but at the peak, we all gaze at the single bright moon. So I'm going to end with the rest of that poem by Mary Oliver. Work, and this is number seven, seventh part. It may be the rock in the field is also a song, and it may be the ears of corn swelling under their green sleeves are also songs, and it may be the river glancing and leaning against the dark stone is also a deliberate music. So I will write my poem, but I will leave room for the world. I will write my poem tenderly and simply, but I will leave room for the wind combing the grass, for the feather falling out of the grouse's fantail and fluttering down like a song. And I will sing for the bones of my wrists, supple and exemplary, and the narrow paths of my brain, its lightnings and issues, its flags, its ideas, and the mystery of the number three. I will sing for the iron doors of the prison and for the broken doors of the poor and for the sorrow of the rich who are mistaken and lonely. And I will sing for the white dog forever tied up in the orchard. And I will sing for the morning sun and its panels of pink and green on the quiet water and for the loons passing over the house. I will sing for the spirit of Luke. I will sing for the ghost of Shelley. I will sing for the Janes and their careful brooms. I will sing for the salt and the pepper in their little towers on the clean table. I will sing for the rabbit that has crossed our yard in the moonlight, stopping twice to stamp the cold ground with his narrow foot. I will sing for the two coyotes who came at me with their strong teeth and then, at the last moment, began to smile. I will sing for the veil that never lifts. I will sing for the veil that begins once in a lifetime, maybe, to lift. I will sing for the rent in the veil. I will sing for what is in front of the veil, the floating light. I will sing for what is behind the veil, light, light, and more light. This is the world, and this is the work of the world. So we have some time for you to say what you want to say. If anything came alive in you in listening, or you object to anything, or it affirms something, I just encourage you to share if you want to.
Well, at first, when I began listening to you, I began to wonder, how in the world could you do that? You know, a pastor. But then I began thinking, when my wife was in the hospital, we had a man I saw after, actually, was an evangelical Christian. And he was about as far over here as I'm, you know, he's quite different. But I, whenever we went into the hospital, I always wanted to seek him out, just because he was so kind. He was, you know, he was very warm, and we didn't get into too much, you know, theological differences, because we would, that would be huge. But there was enough bridge to make the connection. And when, at times, I would like to get him to sing the Lord's Prayer. But when he would do that, I would usually translate that to some of the various translations of the Lord's Prayer from Aramaic, which sound like Taoism to me. So then I began to see, well, okay, you know, you're there much more as being a very kind, warm, caring human being, I think, than having some kind of religious background.
Thank you. Yes.
Where are you at now? I mean, and do you also, are you still working for the year, or do you, where are you going to take this?
I'm still registered in their HR department as called on-call casual status, which means nothing. Which means, I mean, I have a connection, but I'm not really working. I'm looking for a job, actually. Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
I'm not like you, where I don't have a lot of Western medicine. I'm not really appreciative of Western medicine, but I'm sure if I really had a crisis, I would have to wait. And then in the hospital, I would just be thrilling to run into someone like you there. Nothing else, to be able to be not being able to talk about the medicine part of it, not being Western, but I get a little concerned about that, you know, you never know what will happen to any of us, and I am a therapy really strange for me, and the medicine and stuff, but I would really appreciate you, but hearing just now, I mean, you finding that you were able to work with someone, Buddhist or whatever, it's a great culture.
I wish I could have been there. I wish I could have been there. Go ahead, and Jerry, I'll go after you.
You said you're looking for a job, so I'm just curious, what kind of a job would you like to have if you could choose whatever job you wanted?
Oh, I like a half-time job. Somewhere where I could also offer up some, contribute some programming that might actually shift the environment towards, you know, meditation and just creative stuff, plus visiting with people. That would be ideal for me. Yeah. But I don't know where exactly this is going to be. Yeah.
I just wondered, when you perform your chaplaincy, do you go wearing the raiments of your...
No. No, I wear ordinary clothes. Yeah, we all do. The Catholic priests wear Catholic priest outfits, but everybody else wears, you know, just work clothes. Yeah.
Did the program have, the people in the program have any problem with you being a Buddhist, or did that come up in any...
You know, when they invited me to be an intern at Abbott, now that I know a little bit about clinical pastoral education, I think the supervisor, who is the teacher, she actually wants to stir things up. So she had four Lutheran seminarians and me. And part of the interest for her is, how upset can she get them? You know, she that they like to mix it up. So, in the training, you know, to kind of shake them loose a little bit, if they need that. So that was...
Your internship was at Abbott?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was at Fairview?
My residency.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jerry. I was thinking, if you were getting in your shoes, who would be the most difficult patient to deal with? And it would be the patient who is totally convinced that interpretation of Jesus being kind of sacrificial lamb in order to salvation for this patient. And I thought, well, you know, we all bring preconceptions of, I mean, what kindness is and what healing is and kind of what the framework is, whether it's Buddhist or Christian or a particular brand or a particular view within Christianity, that there's one that really, you know, pushes my buttons. And I was just wondering if you could comment on how you handle situations where both either you or probably more often patient had a kind of fairly basic view of how comfort was going to happen and how salvation was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes there can be a late death scenario too that goes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily that. I'm just kind of curious if you comment on limitations that each brings to how we're going to encounter each other.
Yeah. Well, that one example I gave of the woman I was having this heart-to-heart with, and then she just got a clue that I probably wasn't even a Christian. And the iron gates went down. And I struggled with that moment. Like, how could we reconnect? I mean, that was my agenda. And it was a mistake. We couldn't. You know? So... So that was the worst case scenario for me around that. That was just so heartbreaking. And I checked in with another chaplain later, and this very cool lady said, well, in that situation, she just would have, and I realized I should have, instead of kept on trying to stay connected, to just say, oh, well, I'm kind of guessing this isn't working for you. Is that true? Would you like me to find you a Lutheran chaplain? I can do that, because I want you to have the support that you really need. You know, that would have been actually more skillful. But I kind of went deer in the headlights, like, oh my God, now what do I do? So that was one. There were just a few times where she didn't exactly attack me, although she did say, aren't you worried? You know, you don't know where you're going to go when you die. And I was thinking, and you do? You know, I'm sorry, that's what I was thinking. I didn't say that. And I said, she said, doesn't that worry you? And I said, well, I don't really think about it that much. She was like, wow. So we were both like, what? Yes.
What I heard you say,
among people who were very, many of whom, you know, were still in their ghettos. And it's very hard to be among citizens when you're the leader and they're expecting something from you.
Yeah.
And people are still in their ghettos. But you're noticing the river when you were with the that the practice enables you to be open to the moment and to trust.
Yeah.
And also to let go.
Yeah.
To trust here. Let go.
Yeah. Exactly. That was the fun part.
Yeah. And I wanted to choose the word because I thought you were like a woman, a warrior. And then I thought because of your rock and everything, I think no war, no warrior. But a warrior who is ready by a dharma, a sangha, becoming, you know, that you're equipped and ready to go into that world and to emanate who you are. And so I planned another word for
strong practice. Definitely challenging. And also showing me my own limitations of my habits of mind constantly, which was great. That's why I said it was being in a monastery, you know. Like, oh, whoop, whoop, whoop. They're subtle. They're not so big and hunky, but like little ones. Yes, dear?
I just mentioned Buddha Dharma Sangha, and that made me think of something else that I've asked them before. Buddhas take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, Christians take refuge in Jesus.
Yeah.
Buddhists, Zen, anyway, you don't have to do anything, you're already enlightened in Christianity, you don't have to do anything. Jesus, mm-hmm. You know, there's clearly a difference, but mm-hmm. also it's pretty close in some way. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm pushing the translation.
Well, you know, if you go to China and you do exoteric Buddhism in China, then it sounds exactly like Christianity. The Lord Buddha will save us. I mean, I had to Chinese patients and they were like, I said, do you want me to bring you some, a Buddha statue, or would you like me to do a little service? And they said, if you do that, well, he'll be able to eat. He had a feeding tube. And I said, well, I can't really promise that. You know, that. So the cultural Buddhism in China is just not different. It's really not different. You supplicate to the Lord Buddha or the Lord Jesus, and then good stuff happens. And the monks were like, we'll do everything. We're Christians. We do our monk thing. We ask Jesus. It was all about supplicating. You know, fine. Pray to everybody. That's all the monk patients were like that. They had all those strings, lots of strings from their prayer stuff. And then like, oh yeah, and we go to a Christian church because we're in America and we want those good bennies too. You know, that's how they did it. So that's how I did it. Okay. Let's pray to Jesus then. I hope it works. So just getting that opportunity to be the world traveler with no idea of how this is supposed to go. Yeah.
If it's any consolation, I had a Catholic priest, another visit of a pastor, said, or asked, you believe in Jesus as the Lord and Savior, don't you? And I said, yep. Father, sorry, thank you. And so then the doors went down pretty quickly. He left fairly quickly.
This was which hospital? Yeah. Where are you in? What was his name?
Region.
Oh.
The Catholic priests have a little different role.
Oh, okay. Because that was any of the
fuzzy pastors.
Oh. Yeah. Like, I'm glad it wasn't at my place. They're not supposed to be like that there.
They're not.
They're
goofy.
Is there anything else anybody wants to bring up before we have a snack?
Well,
Naku.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. I was interested that you were saying, or can you talk a little bit more about the thing you were surprised by home?
Yeah. Do you want to say more about it?
No, I wanted you to say more about it.
Tried to get out of it.
I mean, it's surprising to me that it surprised you.
Yeah.
There was so much talk about hope.
Yeah. Well, in Buddhist practice, hope is like futuring, you know. So I kind of, first I didn't know how to translate it, you know. But if I translate it into freedom, then it's not a problem. But the way it was being used, it was usually, if these conditions arise, then there will, look. And so that sounded crazy to me, but that's mostly how it was used. So then I was like, oh boy, I need to understand this more deeply, you know, and then how can I retranslate this for myself so that I can stand in it when people say hope and I can have something authentic to be in, you know.
Yeah.
So
freedom is
Oh, and the greatest thing was when I had this completely like BFO, blinding flash of the obvious, when I realized that I had this total idea that, I'm embarrassed to even say this, but I had this idea that Christians like Methodists and then there's Episcopalians and there's this and that, they all believed the same like little thing and about whatever that was. That was their theology. And then I had this blinding flash, the obvious, that actually that wasn't true at all. And that each person, no matter what their Christian tradition, each person, not even each church, had their own theology. Like, isn't that embarrassing? But really, that's how stupid I was. It was just like, oops, that makes sense. But that was a conditioning from childhood. Because raised in a Jewish home, well, you knew each person had their own theology. I mean, there's just arguing. There's no. So I had the idea that Christians who were, you know, those people, all believed the same thing. I was so stupid. But I am now reformed in my belief. Yes.
So, Marilyn, when you went to the,
the hospital?
No,
the residency.
They kind of train you all to do sort of the same thing, regardless of what your faith,
right,
quote unquote.
Yep.
And so they just aim you. They don't necessarily say, "Well, send Marilyn here because she'd be good for these people."
No, they do. They did. I mean, because some people would say they want a Buddhist, and they go, "Oh, we have one." So sometimes they did, or sometimes they said, "We have a Jewish patient. Eek! Send me all." At least she can say it right, you know. So, but that was, didn't happen too much.
But they didn't have reservations about sending you to a born-again Christian?
They didn't know. I had a whole unit that was mine. So they didn't know.
Okay.
But, you know, they probably would have had. Might not. Well, they might have sent me there because they're very cool. It's kind of like that's that person's problem.
Huh.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Okay. I think we're done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.